Welcome to NFP, the Non-Fungible Podcast, with your host, Dee Klein. Today on NFP, my guest is polymath Lee Jaffe, who joins me to discuss his art, spanning from painting to photography to music, poetry, and more. We talk about his work through the years and his many incredible collaborations with artistic legends, including Bob Marley, Peter Tosh, Jean-Michel Basquiat, and Andy Warhol. Our discussion veers toward the nefarious origins of cannabis criminalization and ends with a discussion about how Jaffe envisions harnessing NFT technology in his work. Hey, this is NFP, the Non-Fungible Podcast, with me, Dee Klein. Today's episode is brought to you by the Koi Network. Koi makes minting NFTs super easy and inexpensive. Just drag and drop your file using their NFT wallet, Finny, and Koi takes care of the rest. Minting costs as little as 1 cent, so you can create as many NFTs as you want. And when they're viewed by other people, you even earn Koi tokens that you can use to fund your next series. Check it out at koii.network. Right on, Lee Jaffe. Thank you so much for joining me on NFP today. I'm just so glad to have you here with me. You were telling me that you were looking out of your window there at the cloudy, rainy, miserable New Jersey weather, yet at the same time, you said it's the perfect time to get out and take some pictures.
Yeah, well, that's what I do. So, but, it, you know, like when the weather's like this, it's very, you know, interesting visual stuff.
Yeah.
Taking pictures of the water, the Hudson River, and the clouds moving over the George Washington Bridge. And so it's a good day like that.
Now, of course, you know, for listeners, photography is only one of many media that you specialize in. Looking at your broadly ranged career, I'm just fascinated by how you've had so much success in so many different areas. And maybe we can trace back to, you know, days.
Well, it's like Bob Dylan said, there's no success like failure, and failure is no success at all.
Right. Well, I'd certainly say you've found a great deal of success, genuine success, and just learning about your story and learning about your time with people like Bob Marley and Basquiat, and those are just fascinating stories. And you know, one photo that I was looking at and learning about that struck me was this particular one. You talked about a Polaroid you took of Bob Marley. Could you tell me about that picture a little bit? The one that you took, that you said in another interview I listened to, you said it was one of your favorite pieces.
The one reading the Bible?
Yes.
Yeah. So that was around the first few weeks I was in Jamaica in 1973, and I really loved going, you know, just seeing the island. And Bob was like giving me tours, usually with his cousin Sledger, driving. Sometimes he would drive. And I used to love to go to the country, and he took me to this little tiny village where he was born, in the mountains of St. Anne's province, parish. And I used to really love to go there. It was kind of the roots of the music and the culture. And I had a Polaroid camera at the time, one of those fold-out things that you could adjust. It had a little thing on the lens where you could move it around and adjust the aperture. So it gave you like some control. And it had been raining and the rain stopped. And we were just up the hill from the little shack where Bob was born. And he took out his Bible, and he was reading from it. And I thought, wow, this is really iconic thing. I mean, I mean, nobody outside of Jamaica and the Jamaican diaspora knew who Bob Marley was.
Mm.
But I knew who he was. And I'm thinking, wow, this is like really an important, it just seemed like this really important moment that I was witnessing. I was witnessing him right where he was born. And here he is, he's reading the Bible and Psalms of David, where he got a lot of inspiration for songs.
Mm.
And I had my camera and I was, you know, was really kind of reluctant to inject myself into that moment.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like, you know, when you take a photograph, you're taking something. So I was hesitant, reluctant, didn't know whether I should do it, but it was so compelling. The image was so compelling and felt so important. So I got up the nerve and I clicked, and I was really nervous and I started to pull. So the film, it came, you pulled it out, and then after you pulled it out of the camera, there was another piece that you pulled off the picture, and you had to leave that on there for, I don't know, 60 seconds or something, to let the film develop.
A long 60 seconds.
It started
if
to
you're
pull
excited,
it out too
right?
soon. And I saw it hadn't developed, so I pushed it back. And then it came out with this kind of bright light shining on his shoulder, and I had the rest of him. And it seemed like some otherworldly reflection from heaven or something.
Hmm. Kind of an organic.
Anyway, I love the picture.
Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah. No, I just, I find it's very infused with spirit, you know, with the story that's there. So, and then that overexposure light just really is the icing on the cake, so to speak.
Yeah. And then he got his guitar.
Hmm.
And I had an acoustic guitar. And kind of took with him everywhere.
Uh-huh.
And started singing the song, Kaya. Uh-huh. And I just thought, wow, how did he make this up? But then later I found out that he had actually recorded that song some years earlier.
Okay.
But I really loved it. And later he re-recorded it for an album for Island. Mm-hmm. And named it the album Kaya. I think I instigated that a little bit. I loved it so much.
So there must have been, like just looking through your photography, you must have had that feeling often of like, oh, this is a special moment.
Well, I lived in this house with Bob for 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
And we were together like, I don't know, 80% of the time.
Mm-hmm.
And every moment I thought was totally incredible. And I was like amazed to be in that with him, the musicians that were surrounding him, and that he was collaborating with Peter Tosh and Bunny, Family Man, Carly, Tyrone later. I just felt really privileged.
Mm-hmm.
It was just constant amazement of how amazing these people were. And of course, Bob.
Right, of course. Yeah.
Spending so much time with him.
Yeah, you talked about like this idea of like almost like intruding on those moments with your photography. Did that, being that you were there over so much time, did that become something where it wasn't really felt that way? Like, eventually, people would just kind of accept that this camera was capturing these moments, or.
Well, I mean, I didn't really take that many pictures the time I was there. And part of that was I didn't want to feel like, capturing things
I see.
time. And I was this white guy in the middle of this, political turmoil.
Right.
There was this global battle going on that was playing out also very much in Jamaica between the US government, the CIA, which was overthrowing governments and putting in fascist dictators in Chile and Brazil and different Latin America places, and the Vietnam War. And Jamaica had a socialist prime minister who the whalers helped to elect. And Jamaica being so close to Cuba, like on a clear day, if you're on the North Coast, you could look out and see Cuba. And there were Cuban engineers helping to build bridges in Jamaica. And there was the CIA fomenting gang warfare. And I'm this white guy. What am I doing there? Am I a CIA guy or
Right, because I mean, when you first went there, it was not
why am I
intended to be a
taking
long-term
pictures,
stay, right? Right? Yeah, right. You mean, wasn't the initial plan just to be there for like a few days and you ended up sticking around, basically?
Yeah, well, there was a place for me to stay. Island Records founder Chris Blackwell had bought this house on the north, up the road from where the prime minister lived. It's an old colonial great house, kind of run down, nothing like in its glorious colonial days. It must have been a real fancy place. But it was uptown, and the idea was he was going to have a little office. It was going to be like Island Records was a UK-based record company and was being very successful, with some big, popular artists, Traffic, Cat Stevens, Joe Cocker, and is also recording records with less commercial artists like Nick Drake and John Martin. So it was a really fantastic, from my point of view, record label. And now they had signed the Wailers. It seemed like a really big deal. It seemed like a big deal in the sense that it seemed like it was affording these guys the possibility of this political, social, spiritual, revolutionary lyrics to get out to a really big audience, global audience. And I kind of like was hitting it off with Bob. I played harmonica, he played guitar, so we kind of hit it off on like a kind of musical level. And I think he liked having my views culturally. of like what was going on in the U.S.
I see.
Like seeing that through my eyes was like informing him. I mean, there was no internet in those days. And,
of course, yeah.
So I was just supposed to be there for a few days in Jamaica, but Chris asked me if I wanted to help to organize a North American tour, and Island Records at that time in North America, they didn't really have a staff.
Okay.
They were based in London, where they had a big presence, recording studios and promotion and distribution and all that. But in the US, they were licensing all the records to Capitol Records. And they only had one tiny little office in New York in the Capitol Records building. And so he asked me if I would be interested to help organize a tour, a North America tour. So I didn't know anything about it, but it didn't seem like, it wasn't like rocket science. And I was excited to be part of what I thought could really be something really, really important. So I took on the challenge, and that led to me having a reason to be there.
Of course, yeah.
Because I wasn't going to be there like as a photographer, and I wasn't going to be there as a harmonica player, although eventually I got to play on the third Island album and get to play on stage and live out this kind of dream fantasy thing. But
that's what I'm fascinated by, is you go from this kind of photographer to musician to poet to artist, and it just all seems to have happened just organically as opportunities arose in your life, where you know, it's just fascinating. Like, for example, the Peter Tosh photo of him sitting in this field of marijuana. The famous photo was used for the Legalize It album. Can you talk to me about how that came to happen?
Yeah, so after the Naughty Dread tour, well, before the Naughty Dread album was recorded, Peter and Bunny, Bob's original two partners in the Wailers, left to do solo albums. And there was a lot of friction. The first two albums on Island didn't sell. It got a lot of critical acclaim, a lot of media attention, but no sales. I mean, literally. I remember one time when the Burnin' album came out, I was in this little tiny office, which comprised Island Records in North America. Jim Capaldi, the drummer and co-writer of all the songs for Traffic, which was a huge group at the time, and they had broken up, and Jim had made his own solo album. And I remember being in the office there in the Capitol Records building, and Capaldi walked in, and he had this sheet of paper with the sales report. And I said, "Well, how's Burnin' doing?" And he said, "Oh," he looked at the thing and said, "Oh, the returns are good," which meant in those days, if the records didn't sell, the record stores returned the records. So it was this kind of ironic joke, like, the returns are good.
I see.
Now it sold like 1,200 copies.
The lack of sales are good, essentially.
So I mean, Capaldi was this brilliant lyricist, and you know.
So how did that feel, being there, knowing this stuff was brilliant, and just not seeing it translate into that acceptance?
You know, it was like, you know, banging your head against the wall.
Yeah.
I was trying to get like trying to get airplay, because you needed to be on the radio to get any substantial sale.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, you know, there was no internet. So we didn't fit. The music didn't fit into any category. Like they were, you know, they were viewed like black people, and this music didn't seem like rock.
Right.
And then it didn't fit into the R&B stations, into the black. So it was really, really difficult. I did make some headway with one station in San Francisco, which was the first commercial radio station to play. This was called KSAN. And that was, you know, it was just calling them all the time, trying to get them to play the record. And, but they liked it. And San Francisco was a very progressive place.
Mm-hmm.
And they were the first ones. And there was one station in Boston, BCN. Those were the first two places that I got any airplay. I mean, because I was in charge of...
Well, you must have kind of felt like it was on you in a sense, right? Because you were that American contact, you know?
I was the guy.
You were the go-to guy.
It was nobody else. It was just me.
So you had to have felt pressure from that.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, but...
You wanted to see them be successful with it in America, right?
Yeah, and then, you know, I mean, I was really close with Bob, and he was under a lot of pressure. You know, those first two albums not selling, and it was Peter and Bunny. They didn't have song. They only had a couple of songs on those albums. Mm-hmm. Bob had a little bit of money coming in from songs that an artist called Johnny Nash had recorded on an album that really sold a lot. He had a big hit single called I Can See Clearly Now. So the album sold. It was always a point of contention with Bob because he felt he had co-written that song, but didn't get credit, which would have really made him a lot of money. But he had credit for two other songs. So he had a little bit of money coming in from that. But he had, you know, three kids, and his wife was pregnant, four kids, and his wife was pregnant, Rita, and felt the pressure of his band partners. And and he was the voice of the people, the poor people in Jamaica. And he felt all, you know, that all that pressure of trying to uplift tens of thousands of people out of poverty. He felt that was his mission, which it kind of was. He was handed this gift on a daily basis of these songs. It seemed like it was coming from Jah. Because I'd sit with him, I'd play harmonica, and he'd write these songs, and it, where did that come from? So yeah. So anyway, I got to play on the record, Naughty Dread album. And the song that I played on became this big hit in Jamaica. Part of it, well, the lyrics were about the repression that the police were putting on Rastas and people with dreadlocks. For smoking herb and being revolutionary and being other, which is where the name dreadlocks came from, because it came from the upper class people. They called the Rosses dread because of the hair, and the idea was, well, they're dreadful to look at. These people are dreadful to look at.
Right, it was kind of a derogatory term.
It was a derogatory, but Rosses took it as a symbol of otherness. So it became a positive thing. So like you would see somebody with dreadlock and you say, want them dready, because it was positive. They reversed it.
Right.
They embraced the otherness of not being part of this neo-colonialist capitalist system. So by the time, so I got to play on this record, and then the record became a big hit, mostly because the lyrics were so topical. They were having these roadblocks, and it went 3 o'clock roadblock, and I had to throw away my little herb stock. And it came from us driving. We were driving in the middle of the night from the west end of the island, Negril, back to Kingston. It was 3 o'clock in the morning, and it was a roadblock. Bob talked his way out of it because he was Bob, and he had a way of doing that. But then this wrote the song in the car. And so it went 3 o'clock roadblock, and I had to throw away my little herb stock. So it was very timely. It was a powerful political statement. It was ironic. And Bob had this incredible sense of humor of making the tragic comic. And because I was playing in the car, and I got to play on when they recorded the record, I was really, really nervous about it, because I thought, oh, this is, you know, my big chance. I'm going to like be on a, I mean, the first two albums didn't sell at all. And he was making a next album, but I'm going to play on it. And I knew for me, this is like some historic thing in my life.
For sure.
It's like a really big moment if I actually get on this record. And yeah, I was really nervous. And when Bob was recording the control booth, it was always packed with people. You know, not just musicians, but people. And I was really nervous. I was stumbling through it. And Bob sent in Family Man, the bass player, to come cue me. And I remember, like, he said to me, okay, when I tap you once on the shoulder, you come in. And when I tap you twice, you come out. And that's how I did it. And then I got to play on stage because the song was a big hit, and I had to have the harmonica because it was such a novelty. Added to why it became so popular was the novelty of having a harmonica, a mouth organ, on a reggae record.
Right.
So, and then the Naughty Dread Tour, it's just an accumulation of all the media. It started to get, the Naughty Dread was the first album that started to sell, and Bob started to play for bigger audiences. And I was on the tour playing on these two songs, Naughty Dread and Talkin' Blues, which he kind of, I was kind of, I wouldn't say an inspiration, but it came from me, because we used to sleep sometimes. Rita was building, Rita Marley, his wife, was building a house about 20 minutes outside of Kingston, and had all these little kids. And who was actually building a next bedroom. But there was no room for me. There was no bedroom for me to sleep or anything. So I used to sleep on the porch, on the veranda, and I'd sleep on the floor. But I mean, I used to kind of love it because I was like, they were like embracing me as like a part of the family. Right. And I'm okay, so I'm sleeping on the floor, and I'm totally fine with it. So I'm like, I loved it really. And I mean, it was, Bob woke up one morning, picked up his guitar. I didn't wake up yet. Reed is like making porridge for the kids and me. And Bob brings out the porridge for me for breakfast. And he starts singing, "Cold Ground Was My Bed Last Night." "Rock Was My Pillow Too" was kind of off me.
Right.
Then I picked up my harmonica, we jammed, and he wrote the song, which is such a genius song, because he has a line, it says, "Your feet are just too big for your shoes." I mean, think about that. Think of the irony of it. It's not your shoes are too small. He said, "Your feet are too big for your shoes." That's so deep on so many levels. I was just like, how did you think of that? Where did that come from? It was just like such a genius thing. So, and I got to play on that. So I got to play the first time I played on stage. Marvin Gaye, "Come to Jamaica," and he had this record, "What's Going On," which was number one worldwide hit. Mm-hmm. And Jamaica, it was just huge. I mean, it was huge all over the world, but it was really huge in Jamaica. And of course, it was a very socially conscious, political record. And that's a lot of why it was so big. And he could have sold out National Stadium a couple of times, but he wanted to play in a smaller venue, and he wanted to play the whole album, and he brought a 70-piece orchestra.
Oh, wow.
So he could play the whole album. And it was going to be in a theater, like a 1,500 seat theater. And the promoter came around to our house at Hope Road to see if the Wailers would open for him. And the Wailers hadn't played in Jamaica in years and years.
Okay.
Naughty Dread album hadn't come out yet, but the single, Rebel Music, 3 o'clock Roadblock, had come out.
Okay.
And had blown up. And at first, the radio stations wouldn't play it. It was like hitting like the dance hall, and it was on the street, and like you could hear it, but Jamaican radio wouldn't play it. And Bob and his friend Skill Cole, who was, like, I guess, the most famous Jamaican athlete, he was a soccer player and had been playing in Brazil on the same club that Pelé had played for, Santos. And he was a big, strong guy. And Bob had these two little teenage gangsters who were like infamous gunmen. He like had them be my bodyguards if I had to go someplace without him. he made them follow me. I didn't think I needed a bodyguard. But anyway, they used to go to the radio station, and Skill Call had a baseball bat. They don't play baseball in Jamaica. So it was a dangerous object. It was a scary, dangerous object. And they'd have me sit in the car with the radio on, and they'd go up to the radio station, make the DJ play the record on the radio, and they'd have me in the car to listen to see if it was actually on the radio. And the record blew up. It was like a big hit. When they came to ask to see if the Wells would open for Marvin Gaye, they were already kind of breaking up. But it was Marvin Gaye, and it was this big thing. So they agreed, Bunny and Peter agreed. And they only played six songs. But they had to play the song, because the song was the number one song in Jamaica.
Sure.
I had to have the harmonica because it's all over the record. So yeah, I did a good job. Bob introduced me. It was the last song they played, and they didn't do an encore. And I just walked on stage, and Bob said, this is Lee, engineer, don't turn them up too loud. And then I killed it. I did good, really good. People really
didn't need
liked
any
it.
Taps on the shoulder anymore.
I had a long solo, and maybe played too much. I don't know. I was good. I was good enough. I was good enough that the next day at Hope Road, Bunny Wailer was there, and he announced to everybody that I was in the Wailers. So then I got to play on stage on the Naughty Dread tour, and then Bob was starting to blow up already from that album, and he got a new manager.
Uh-huh.
I was never really the manager. I just organized those first two tours. And I didn't have any designs on being a manager. My job was an artist, so it wasn't to be managing business.
Right.
So
you kind of just stepped into that role to help out, so to speak.
Yeah, there was no one to do it, so
right
at that time.
Mm-hmm.
So now he had a manager. He was playing for big audiences. I felt like I did my job. And I got a call from Peter saying, would you come and listen to these songs? He wanted to do a solo album. And I went to see him, and he, on his acoustic guitar, he played me 30 songs.
Mm.
And the first two Island albums that were, wasn't called Bob Marley, and it was called The Wailers, Peter only had three songs total on those two albums. And that's when it became obvious to me why he left Bob. Because he had 30 songs to
tons of music.
Unbelievable
make,
songs.
Right? Yeah, right.
And he had this anthem, Legalize It. I knew that was important. And that the album should be called Legalize It. It was so much part of the culture and so much part of the Rasta thing.
Right.
And social and political, about political repression.
Mm-hmm.
And Bob had taken me one of the times that we went up to, I used to love to go there, to this little village where he was born. And one time we went there, and he took me through this trek through the mountains with his cousin Sledger. And we go over one mountain into a valley, up the next mountain. And then I'm looking down in this valley, and it's filled with herb plants, and it's kind of like, it was like glowing. And it was the first time I had ever seen a cannabis plant growing.
Right.
I mean, I had been, you know, from college, you know, I started smoking herb when I was like 15 or 16. I was an early adapter. But I never saw an actual plant. And it really struck me when Peter had the song that that should be the cover. It should be Peter in an herb field, because I knew people in North America, Europe, they didn't know what it looked like.
Sure.
And it made it look like it's not a drug. It's a natural plant. So that's where the idea to shoot that album cover came from.
Yeah, that's awesome. What a great story. It just makes me think about just kind of the whole story of criminalization of cannabis, especially in America, and just the political motivations. I mean, if you go back to, say, Nixon, and what was his aide name? I think it was Ehrlichman. Is that correct?
One of his guys was Ehrlichman.
I think so. And he basically said, well, this was, we knew that it wasn't harmful to people and it didn't cause
it went back
all these,
to earlier into the 30s.
The 30s, right? When they kind of associated it with Mexican.
That was a
crime,
racist thing. They called it marijuana.
Right.
And it had to do with
It's a very sad sort of story when you look into it.
It had to do with hemp, which is the same. And William Randolph Hearst owned all these newspapers and owned all these forests.
Mm-hmm.
So they were making the paper from the trees, and they didn't want to make the paper from the hemp.
Competition.
Yeah, because they owned all the trees. So, you know, why should we change into some sustainable thing? When we're making all this money, we own the paper, we own everything. And then it fed into this whole racist thing, and we'll just outlaw it. So that's where the history.
Well, I think, what was it in the 30s? I think it was in, I think the guy's name was Al Singer or something like that. I can't remember the name.
Yeah.
Is that correct?
Yeah.
He kind of was the one who touted it as this scary, you know, drug that would cause, you know, psychotic violence.
Mexican violence.
Right. And just the propaganda that came with that, and portraying, you know, Mexicans in very stereotypical imagery, sombreros and so forth. Sorry?
Right up through Trump.
Absolutely.
Continuing the whole thing.
Yeah.
You know, sending rapists and blah, blah, blah. It was still going on.
Totally. Yeah. It's, I don't even know the words to describe it. It's something where it's still to this day somewhat baffling to me that it persists. You know, you still have, there's parts of the states where it's been legalized, but it's still not totally legal, you know, in the states. And
it's, federally,
you know,
because
of that political background, it's a tool.
A lot of people incarcerated in the United States,
like 50%, I think, is from marijuana usage. It's some insane number.
Yeah. So the battle's still going on.
Mm-hmm.
We've been winning some battles, but it continues.
Yeah. And like you say, it's inexorably tied to racism, you know, and obviously that's something that in your work comes up a lot, the political and racist elements. You know, I did want to ask you about someone else very special in your life that a lot of my listeners would be really keen on talking about is Jean-Michel Basquiat and your time with him. And I'd be interested in hearing your story about Basquiat as well. Now, of course, people may not know this, but some of your photos of Bob Marley, I think it's Bob Marley and Basquiat, as well as Peter Tosh, are on Super Rare. And this is relatively new for you, right? The whole NFT experience. How long have you been in Super Rare?
I met this guy. He said he would buy one.
Okay.
He had bought this this Beeples NFT.
Oh, okay.
For $30 million.
Mm-hmm.
I met this guy by chance at a talk.
You meet a lot of people by chance, it seems like, that are like pretty interesting people. Because your encounter with Basquiat was kind of by chance too, was it not?
I guess everything is by chance.
I suppose you can make that argument. Yeah. Anyway, sorry, I interrupted you. You were saying this person that was...
I was really interested in NFTs from when it started. I come from a conceptual art background.
Mm-hmm.
One of the initiators in the late 60s, early 70s of what came to be known as conceptual art, which was art. Part of that intrinsically was to not make objects. So NFTs seemed really interesting for me. Mm-hmm. I also saw it as a game changer for artists, because it gave artists opportunity, really for the first time, to gain royalties from resale of the work. So yeah, so I guess I was kind of late to the game, and I had a few different people trying to bring me into it. They said that they would help me and advise me, and three or four different groups of people, and none of them actually came through and were helping me.
Mm.
And then I met this guy at this place called Neuhaus, where I had done a book launch from this book, this Basquiat book that I had done.
Uh-huh.
And they were having a panel, this NFT panel discussion there. I just happened to be there by chance. And he was, he's saying he bought this Beeples for $30 million. And I was like, okay. And at the end of the talk, at the panel, he was like surrounded by people, and they had my book.
Okay.
My book was there at the place at Neuhaus, because I had given a talk there, and they had some books, and they had my book. So I took my book and I kind of pushed my way through the crowd of people around him, everybody wanting to talk to him. And I said, oh, I did this book. Can you help me with NFTs? He was kind of annoyed that I like pushed my way, and then he started to go through the book, and he said, who took these photos? And I said, I did. He said, oh, wow, I can help you.
Okay.
This is incredible. I can help you. I'm going to put you in touch. I have these two curators. So they got in touch with me, and they said, okay, here's what we're going to do. We're going to hook you up with Super Rare, and we'll pre-buy one of your NFTs, and that'll make a floor for the price.
Right. Sure.
And then after that, you'll just be on your way.
Mm-hmm.
So they bought one for 4 Ether.
Yep.
Took me months to figure out how to mint it.
The Bob Marley smoking a spliff photo.
Yeah.
This was in November of 2022. Yeah. Okay. Sorry.
This guy, Casey, the Super Rare person,
mm-hmm.
he was really helpful. I got a couple of pictures minted. And I thought, well, these guys, this guy Ryan, who had bought the Beeples and bought mine, they were going to like tweet about it. And now people would buy my pictures. So it's like 6 months later and nobody even looks at them. Well, maybe a couple of people looked at it, but I didn't get one offer. No one is interested. Out of all the thousands of people that buy NFTs, not one person made any offer.
I just hearing what you're saying now and thinking back to what you were saying about Bob Marley earlier and the lack of sales. And then there was this moment of brilliance that happened and there was a breakout. And, you know, it just seems like an interesting parallel story.
Well, I don't know. So now I have new people at Aniko and her group. They think they can help me.
But I think, you know, the tricky part being that just the NFT market is this completely different demographic. So I don't even, people don't realize the brilliance of it. Kind of like what happened with, you know, the Whalers. People just didn't necessarily see it.
Oh, I don't know. People were selling photographs.
What I mean is of you in particular, they don't seem to, you know about you yet in this particular space.
Well, I don't know, because the Casey person, the who kind of runs Super Rare,
mm-hmm.
He has a daily thing
mm-hmm.
that he promotes, and he promoted mine, and they always, he said, I'll do that, and they always get like 1,000 likes.
Right.
But I didn't get any interest. I got
some. Yeah, I mean, if you look at the NFT market as a whole, it's very, very much imploded, literally. Like, it's in terms of sales, it's pretty much collapsed.
I don't know. People are still selling. There's a market. People are buying NFTs.
There is a market, definitely. I just, if you look at the numbers, you know, it's dropped massively since that time, since November.
Right. Yeah, and so, crypto, but it seems to be coming
that
back.
Whole, I don't know if you're familiar with FTX, that whole fiasco with that exchange that collapsed.
Yeah.
But I mean, they were holders of some of the most valuable NFTs in the entire market, you know? And so when people that have money to spend on art are holding their funds on an exchange that evaporates, it's going to cause damage to the entire market.
I think it seems to be a market for photography.
Absolutely. And I'm just saying been in the NFT thing since 2020, and I mean the frothiness of it that was there, where anybody and everybody could sell, is no longer there. It's much a smaller portion of people buying it now.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting for photography, though. I think there's
absolutely. I was going to ask you, like, you know, obviously with you being, you know, kind of this multi-talented person, you've started it with the photography. Have you ever considered doing NFTs with music or with your writing or with poetry or with
I'm very much considering
things like that,
working on some projects that combine music and video.
Yeah, like I'm reminded of the Andy Warhol piece with the $5, $1 bill, the collaboration, you know, and I think there's 1,000 copies of that piece, something like that. Am I correct? 1,000 prints?
No.
Is that accurate? Yeah, it's on Factum Art, an edition of 1,000.
We were going to make $5 bill. We're going to make an edition of 1,000.
Yeah.
And we made 7.
Oh. Okay.
They sent me seven.
Quite a lot less. Okay.
They sent me 7. They did a beautiful job. They sent me 7. The idea is we were going to sell them for 1,000 euros.
Uh-huh.
And each person that I showed it to bought one.
Okay.
And then Factum, we were going to just keep going. And I thought, oh, this is great. I'm going to make some money. This is going to help me fund some of the big projects I'm involved in. And their lawyers at Factum stopped them. And they said, well, you can't be shipping counterfeit money.
Oh, it's counterfeit money. Right. Shit.
So, but I think there's a, I know people wanted these
it's this brilliant piece.
This is a physical object.
Yeah. Yeah. I just think about something like that as an NFT would be brilliant.
Well, I want to do it as an NFT.
Yeah. Because then you is it counterfeit at that point anymore? Not really.
Yeah. And it's also so much about the nature of money.
Exactly. It would be the perfect fit. That's what I wanted to ask you about, was that particular
well,
piece.
I want to start with my new group at Howl.
Mm-hmm.
I've suggested that this should be the first thing we do.
I agree wholeheartedly. It's just such a great
fit. I haven't gotten
fit.
Any enthusiasm back from that idea.
Yeah. But, no, I, just knowing you, people. Knowing this is Andy Warhol, you...
Jean-Michel Basquiat, a Rasta, a Rasta guy brilliant. In Brooklyn who's also a singer and whose kids became this, I produced their first album, Morgan Heritage, and they've become this iconic reggae band.
Mm-hmm.
That's who gave me the $5 bill from their father selling nickel bags in Bushwick.
You spoke about the conceptual.
And where the herb came from. Mm-hmm, it came from my college friends, and who were the biggest smugglers. Mm-hmm. They were smuggling 40,000 pounds of Thai herb at a time on tankers, and that's where I got the herb to give to Dan Roy Morgan, who's had speakeasies.
Uh-huh.
He was able to start from having one record that he sang that became a kind of crossover reggae pop dance hit. Mm-hmm. And he took that money and bought this house. He had 27 kids. Some of them became his band called Morgan Heritage. I mean, it's just like this amazing story of all these levels of society, an international thing. And I think it's the perfect NFT. I think it's...
Well, because again, you talked about conceptual art, and it fits perfectly with the conceptual side of it being this digital technology that's a currency that's, you know, it plays with all those themes.
Yeah.
I wonder about, you know...
It gets to the nature of money.
Yes, exactly. Is there a way to play with that in terms of generative elements that could be kind of... Have you thought about that?
Well, that's what I'm interested in.
Yeah.
I haven't gotten the enthusiasm yet from the Howl people and Aniko. They don't seem so enamored of it.
Oh.
But I'm still trying to convince them.
Well, my opinion is that's the perfect fit for you. But, you know, whether or not that becomes a hit, who knows, you know. To me, it's not even about it becoming a hit. It's about it being just the perfect
look,
alignment.
I know the physical ones that elements. We made.
Yeah.
Every person I showed it to wanted it and paid me right away.
Yep.
Immediately. Mm-hmm. I have to have this.
Yep. No, I think it's brilliant. Can we talk about Basquiat at all? You know, do you have time to talk about your experiences with Basquiat and your travels? And...
Aren't we out of time?
No. I mean, I'm we're not out of time if you've got time.
Well, maybe we can do that in a second.
That's not a bad idea. Catch up on another date. Yeah.
I could do that.
Yeah. No, it's, I think that would be brilliant, honestly. That to me is just a very natural place to start with it. But of course, you know, you're looking at a market that's evolved so much, so rapidly, right, in the NFT space, that it's, there's always something new, right? But to me, it's just, there's a timeless element to your work that will carry over to the space. And maybe people don't see it today in the NFT space, but.
Well, there's a lot of interest in the, you know, in the collaborations that Jean-Michel did with Warhol. There's a show on in Paris. There's going to be another one in LA. I think this is the most important collaboration Jean-Michel did with Andy. As from my point of view, anyway. I think it's the most important one. It's the most profound and deepest on the most possible levels.
Right. So are there other things you are thinking of bringing to the NFT space then, if this is not the only one? Because you said, you know, there were other ideas.
Well,
or are you not free to divulge them?
I'm following these HAL people. I trust them that they know what they're doing. I have confidence in them. So right. I just try to follow.
I don't know what you can tell me and what you can't tell me. I'm just, you know, curious in terms of what you're imagining might happen.
I'm imagining everything I do is NFTs, so.
Right. That's the beauty of it, right?
I'm just waiting for these people that really know about it, that I've thrown in with, to guide me, to see what they think is best to start with.
Mm-hmm. Another interesting take on this, I think, with the this particular piece, the $5 bill. Are you familiar with Bitcoin ordinals?
No.
But Bitcoin ordinals are NFTs that are a singular Satoshi, which is the smallest increment of Bitcoin. And what you do is you attach, so to speak, I'm not going to get into technicalities of it. Basically, you attach this particular image to a Bitcoin Satoshi, and it's an ordinal. It's kind of a newer thing in the NFT space.
This sounds really interesting.
But it would be such a phenomenal fit for this, because Bitcoin is, you know, the, you know, decentralized currency. And
it's limited. Bitcoin's limited.
It's immutable. It's limited. So, hey, I like Ethereum too, but it does not have the scarcity of Bitcoin. It's, you know, deflationary, yes, but Bitcoin is a fixed amount of Satoshis, right?
Really,
that will ever exist.
Really, really interesting.
So that's something I would encourage you to look into. And I think that would be a phenomenal fit for this, because it just really fits the message. And it's kind of a trending thing right now, Bitcoin ordinals. So it is a little bit more clunky right now because it's relatively new. But I'm sure the folks at HAL know a thing or two about how to execute that. But that's something I'd encourage you to ask them about, look into.
Well, I think you just did.
Exactly. That's my hope. I really, no, I just feel like it just fits that environment so perfectly. It would really resonate with all the things that you're talking about here and just everything that's happening with that artwork.
Yeah. And like the things I did with Jean-Michel, book is really popular and doing well. It's gone to a second printing already. The Basquiat family has this big show. They've been using my photos from that book. They used in the show they had in New York. It was on for 9 months. It was really popular. Mm-hmm. And now it's on in LA. And they have giant 25-foot high photographs at the two entrances of my pictures. So, and the $5 bill is really like an introduction to the story.
Right.
My story was Jean-Michel.
Absolutely, yeah.
That's why I think it would be a really good way to start.
I agree.
my
100%. How, if you're listening, you got to do it.
Okay, so maybe our next episode that we do will be about this.
That would be great. I would love to hear more about your experiences with Basquiat and talk about this for sure.
Okay, great.
Yeah. Well, hey, thank you very much for spending this time talking with me. I really appreciate you sitting down with me. And okay, granted, it was kind of rainy and miserable outside anyway, and you'd said you were procrastinating, but nevertheless, I appreciate you sitting down with me for this time.
And I appreciate you spending the time.
Right on. Well, hey, have a great day. Enjoy going out and taking some photos in that perfectly diffused light that you have right now with the clouds.
Yeah.
and we'll catch up later.
All right. Thanks so much, man.
Absolutely.
It was my pleasure.
For sure. Have an awesome day.
You too. Bye.
Hey, if you enjoyed this episode of NFP with D. Klein, please like and subscribe on your favorite podcasting platform. Thanks again for listening to the Non-Fungible Podcast. See you again soon.